that.
This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Joe Biden is calling the struggle to reopen U.S. schools amid the coronavirus a national emergency, and he's accusing U.S. President Donald Trump of ignoring the issue and stoking unrest in Wisconsin and elsewhere. The Democratic presidential nominee's broadsides came a day ahead of his own scheduled trip to Kenosha, Wisconsin, where Biden said he wants to help heal a city reeling from another police shooting of a black man. The wounding of Jacob Blake and subsequent demonstrations have made the political battleground state a focal point for debate over police and protest-related violence. Biden's visit comes 2 days after President Donald Trump visited the region. On Wednesday, Mr. Trump marked Japan's surrender in World War II by saluting American strength. The United States federal government has told states to prepare for a coronavirus vaccine to be ready to be distributed by November 1st. The timeline raised concern among public health experts about an October surprise, a vaccine approval driven by political considerations ahead of presidential elections rather than science. In a letter to governors dated August 27, the director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention had said states in the near future will receive permit applications from McKesson Corporation. That company has contracted with the CDC to distribute vaccines to places including state and local health departments and hospitals. More than 861,000 people have died globally from COVID-19. The United States had more than 185,000 deaths, and Brazil more than 123,000. India, with the third highest death toll, has more than half of Brazil's numbers. The number of worldwide infections quickly approaches 26 million, with those three countries together making up more than half the world's cases. This is VOA News. Australia's Victoria State Thursday reported a triple-digit rise in new COVID-19 infections for the first time in 4 days, denting optimism that a second wave of cases has been contained. Australia has now recorded more than 26,000 COVID cases, while the death toll rose to 678 after at least 15 people in Victoria State died from the virus. Those strict restrictions have helped to prevent the spread of the virus beyond Victoria. They have wreaked havoc on the economy, with official data on Wednesday showing Australia had entered its first recession in 3 decades. The International Criminal Court Wednesday said moves by the U.S. government to place sanctions on its prosecutor were an attack on international justice and the rule of law. The court was responding after the U.S. government moved to blacklist ICC prosecutor Fatou Bensouda because she had launched an investigation into whether American forces committed war crimes in Afghanistan. In a statement, the world's permanent war crimes court said the sanctions are unprecedented and constitute Rome statute system of international criminal justice and the rule of law more generally. Amnesty International has accused the Iranian government of overseeing a campaign of human rights abuses during a crackdown last year on nationwide protests that were sparked by soaring fuel prices. The rights group said in a report released Wednesday that Iran resorted to torture, rape, and other ill treatment of those involved in the November unrest that rocked the Islamic Republic. Iranian officials said about 200,000 people participated in those protests, while the chair of Parliament's Security Committee estimated at least 7,000 were arrested, and rights groups said the number of detainees was in the thousands. German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas is now urging Russia to investigate, now that it's been confirmed Wednesday that a major critic of Russian President Vladimir Putin was poisoned by a Russian chemical nerve agent. A German government spokesman confirms that 44-year-old Alexei Navalny, who fell into a coma in Russia and is being treated in Berlin, was attacked with a Soviet-style Novichok nerve agent. Novichok is the same nerve agent Britain says Russia used to poison former spy Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia in the British city of Salisbury 2 years ago. Russia has repeatedly denied any involvement in the attack, which the Skripals survived. One member of the public, Don Sturgis, was killed. Decontamination and recovery measures in the city cost millions of pounds. Novichok is a deadly group of nerve agents developed by the Soviet military in the 1970s and 80s. Navalny was airlifted to Germany last month after collapsing on a flight from the Siberian city of Tomsk to Moscow. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
America. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, September 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Cameroon says the separatist conflict is destroying Anglophone region's economies.
It has discouraged investment in these regions. A fall in investment implies a rise in unemployment and a general fall in standard of living. Another consequence is the near collapse of the tourism sector.
The UN said refugees in Sudan face life-threatening risk from floods and coronavirus. Liberia's education minister discusses the impact of COVID-19 lockdown on senior high school girls. South Africa again attempts to reopen schools amid COVID-19. And jailed Zimbabwe journalist Hopewell Chigono has been granted bail.
The bail condition was that he deposits 10,000 Zimbabwe dollars. He deposits his passport and that he should not treat anything to do with protests.
And a new study looks at the aims and missteps of the Sahel Alliance. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Cameroon says the economies of its troubled English-speaking Western regions are collapsing as a result of the country's four-year separatist conflict. Officials say the ongoing fighting has made tax revenues in the English-speaking Northwest region drop from $800,000 annually to just $1,000 last year. As Moki Edwin Kizeka reports from Yaoundé, the lack of government funds has had devastating effects on the region.
Fotso Dominic, the most senior government economic official in the English-speaking Northwest region, says separatist fighters have succeeded in chasing customs and tax officials from almost all crossing points along the border with Nigeria. Speaking on Cameroon State Television, Dominic said there has been a 90% drop in imports of building materials, drugs, vehicles, electronics and basic commodities from Nigeria. This, he says, while civilians have been deprived of basic supplies and state coffers left with huge shortfalls.
Before 2016, the custom duty collection was more than 200 million francs in Donga Mantum and about 150 million from Mentum Division, giving us a total of about 205 million per annum. As we do talk, Donga Mantum last year collected less than 500,000 and nothing was collected from the Mentum area.
Cameroon's government this month reported that the country's second largest employer, the Cameroon Development Corporation, had abandoned most of its banana, palm oil, and rubber plantations. It owes as much as a year's worth of back pay to 6,000 of its 22,000 workers. The palm oil company Pamoro and other agro-industrial companies say they are now heavily in debt. Microfinance institutions that power the economies of Cameroon's English-speaking regions say they are unable to recover $50 million in loans. Merchants have either escaped to safer areas in the French-speaking regions or cannot repay loans because their businesses are closed due to the fighting. The separatists have said on social media that their intention is to ruin Cameroon government's state coffers. Fighters say they want to make the English-speaking regions ungovernable until they obtain their independence. Residents and business people say anyone who disobeys the fighters' calls for a lockdown or is seen paying taxes is subject to retribution. Businessman Protus Awanga says he almost lost his life for disobeying instructions from fighters not to go on a business trip on the week a lockdown was imposed.
That's the most awful moment I've ever had in my life, face to face with gunmen like this. And they ordered us out of the car. We saw our things being burnt, but we were even thankful to God because they would have burnt us in the car. It's really terrible. It's deplorable.
Economist Tasso Gerard says the consequences of the crisis weighs on the government, but it is civilians who are caught in the fighting who suffer most. They include people whose businesses were either torched by separatists for disobeying their instructions to not pay taxes or those whose property was burned by the military, which accused them of supporting the fighters.
It has discouraged investment in these regions. A fall in investment implies a rise in unemployment and a general fall in standard of living. Also, most of the councils in these regions find it difficult to settle their debts and pay their workers. Another consequence is the near collapse of the tourism sector. Most of the recreational areas and touristic sites are abandoned. Most of those in the working age group have migrated to other regions, leaving behind the old and the young in the villages. This high migration implies less farm labor and consequently a fall in agricultural productivity in these regions.
The suffering has not deterred neither the government nor the fighters. Both have maintained their positions for the past 4 years. The separatists are asking for the creation of a breakaway English-speaking state, while the government maintains that Cameroon cannot be divided. The United Nations says the conflict has killed more than 3,000 people and displaced more than 500,000. 50,000 others are asylum seekers in neighboring Nigeria. Moki Edwin Kinzaka for VOA News, Yaounde.
The Zimbabwe High Court on Wednesday granted a $10,000 bail to jailed journalist Hopewell Chigono. He and Jacob Ungare Vume, leader of the Transform Zimbabwe movement, had been in jail since July 20th. The government accuses them of inciting violence on Twitter ahead of a planned July 31st protest against poor governance in Zimbabwe. Lawyer Beatrice Mtetwa says the bail comes with harsh conditions.
The bail conditions was that he deposits $10,000. He deposits his passport. He deposits the title deed to his property with the clerk of court, and that he reports 2 times a week, Mondays and Fridays, at his local police station, and that he stays away from Twitter and should not tweet anything to do with protests, etc. We met all the conditions, paid the bail, and he was released from prison just before 8 this evening.
Beatrice, we are reading that the bail is put at $10,000. Is this usual or unusual?
No, it's Zimbabwe dollars, and the Zimbabwean dollar currently is around $100 to the US dollar. So $10,000 is about $1,000 US. It is not US dollars.
He was arrested along with Ungare Vumbi. Has he also been granted bail?
He actually was granted bail earlier than Hopewell because his case was in the morning, Hopewell's was in the afternoon. Ungare Vume's bail conditions are that he was to deposit 50,000 Zimbabwe dollars. He is to report 3 times a week. He also has been banned from using Twitter, but he was not asked to deposit a title deed to a property. So he also was released. In fact, they were released at the same time.
Are they expected to return to court again?
Yes. In Zimbabwe, you are required to come back to court from time to time until you get a trial date. So they will be going back to court on routine remand until they get a trial date. We have asked the state for a trial date when we go back, so we will see if the magistrate will actually force the state to provide a trial date. The state had said they needed only 2 weeks within which to finalize their investigations and that they would be ready for trial thereafter. And it is 45 days since these guys were arrested and were saying we should have the trial date so that this thing is over and done with. The reporting conditions are stringent. They clearly affect one's freedom and liberty. If you have to report 2 or 3 times a week to a magistrate, it means your freedom of movement is severely curtailed because you can't get out of town if you have to be reporting every other day. Although when one gets bail, at least they get back their freedom, there are restrictions to that freedom if you have reporting conditions, which is why we are saying let's have a trial date and have these allegations tested in court in a trial once and for all so that we put this thing behind us.
Beatrice, thank you so much for speaking with us. Thank you very much.
Welcome.
Beatrice Mtetwa is a lawyer for jailed Zimbabwe journalist Hopewell Chigono. She was speaking with us from the capital, Harare. The UN Refugee Agency says heavy flooding in Sudan is putting the lives of tens of thousands of refugees, internally displaced people, and host communities at increased risk at a time when the coronavirus pandemic is spreading. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
An estimated 125,000 refugees and internally displaced people are affected by Sudan's worst flooding in a century. The UN Refugee Agency says the situation is particularly bad in the regions of East Sudan, White Nile, Darfur, and Khartoum. The agency says shelters have been washed away in the torrential rains. Infrastructure has been destroyed, and latrines have collapsed, heightening the risk of disease. Officials say roads have become too muddy for traffic to pass through, making it impossible to deliver emergency aid to many in desperate need. UNHCR spokeswoman Shabia Mantou says the refugees and displaced people are in dire need of shelter and other relief. She says some have lost all their possessions and face the prospect of starting over.
Hygiene and sanitary levels have plummeted due to flooded latrines and contaminated water supplies, preventing people from exercising necessary COVID prevention measures, such as regular hand washing. Some health facilities have been damaged, hampering their ability to treat patients should the transmission of COVID or other viruses or diseases increase.
Mantou notes many affected by the flooding have previously been displaced by conflict and have been unable to earn a living because of COVID-19 restrictions. She says they are living on a knife's edge and struggling to meet their most basic needs. COVID-19 is the disease caused by the coronavirus. The World Health Organization says Sudan has more than 13,000 coronavirus infections, including 833 deaths. The UNHCR and other aid agencies are working with the Sudanese government to provide emergency aid wherever possible to refugees, other displaced people, and host communities throughout the country. Officials say the devastation caused by this historic flooding will be long-lasting, and people will require support for some time. The UNHCR says it is short of cash and is appealing to international donors for support. The agency notes it has received just 38% of the $275 million it needs for its humanitarian operation until the end of the year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, September 3rd. Senior high school students in Liberia, particularly 12th graders, completed their West African Secondary Certificate examination yesterday, Wednesday. A successful completion of the exams usually determines whether a student graduates from senior high school. Earlier this week, Education Minister Professor Ansu Soni sounded an alarm about the impact that the coronavirus pandemic was having on Liberia's current academic year. He said he was especially worried about senior high school girls, some of whom, he said, were pregnant because of the long coronavirus lockdown and the possibility that they may not be able to complete the school year.
I would wish that the girls would be careful, patient, protective, and then they will go through and complete their school. But should they get pregnant while especially preparing for an examination as this one, original exam, I didn't think we should deprive them from taking the exam once they are physically fit. Now, the religious institutions may likely not condone that. So all we said was, okay, if they cannot stay in your school, then just send them to the public school and we allow them to complete because they are in the 12th grade. The regional exam is scheduled. If they don't take the exam this year, then the entire curriculum changes next year and they will have to repeat the senior high school. But some of them actually let the student remain. I think they're finishing the exam today, finally. So that's very good. I don't think there should be anything we encourage. As a Christian myself, it won't be anything to encourage. But I'm in the public service. And in the public service, all children are our responsibility. and we must find a way to create an opportunity for them, even if they have a situation like they just experienced.
You have also expressed concern, Mr. Minister, not only about the girls, but you're also concerned about some of the young men have gone to the southeastern region of the country to do some artisanal mining. What exactly do you mean?
I didn't go that way. What I really said was we collaborate with the Ministry of Health, and the Ministry of Health has to give a go-ahead for us to resume classes. So my case is, the longer you let the folks stay out of school, the less busy they become, and some of them are likely to find something else outside of the school environment. If that were to happen, then we have an issue. Because once they leave and they go to, say, they go to find a job, ride a motorbike, or they go to dig gold or dig diamond, and they find a livelihood in that, they're not going to come back to school. And that is a problem that we've had even now. Some students, once they decide to do something and begin to earn income, they don't come back. So we have those kind of dropouts, and eventually they remain there. So for us, the longer we stay out of school, the likelihood of that being even more pervasive was my concern.
So, Minister, when do you think then schools are going to reopen?
Officially, for the next academic year, schools are open now. But we staggered the enrollment. We brought them in by levels because we still have the virus obtaining in our country. So we brought them in at different levels. As I'm speaking now, the 12th graders are ending the examination, and the 6th to 9th graders are in school. They will be ending in October. And then the 10th and 11th grade will come in, and they will be ending by November 15. When that happens, the academic year closes officially. We are hoping that by the next 2 months or so down the road, the health people will find a way so that we can open for the next academic year. If everything goes well, we hope to start by December of 2020 to 2021 for the next academic year. Because as you know, we have not yet closed the old academic year, which will be closing this year, November. That's where we are right now.
Thank you so much, Mr. Minister, for taking the time to speak with us. We do appreciate very much.
Thank you for granting me the platform to talk with you, Larry. God bless you then.
That was Professor Ansu Soni, Liberia's Education Minister. He was speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. Across Africa, more than 140 million children are out of school amid coronavirus-related closures. Of those, 14 million are in South Africa, which also is the continent's viral hotspot. In September, after several attempts at closing, then reopening, then reclosing schools, the nation's school system is trying to open for real this time. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
After 5 months of uncertainty and home learning, South Africa is going back to school. The nation closed its 23,000 government schools in March as part of a 9-week lockdown to try to stop the viral spread. They reopened in June, briefly, and then closed again when infections spiked. Most recently, the school system took a 4-week break, sending some 14 million students back home, with plans to resume nationwide in early September. President Cyril Ramaphosa.
Cabinet has decided today that all public schools should take a break for the next 4 weeks. Now, this has also been the experience in a number of other countries where schools have opened and have also had to close due to the circumstances that each country has had to confront.
A recent survey by the World Health Organization found that schools are fully open in only 6 of 39 countries in sub-Saharan Africa. South Africa is among about a dozen countries that plan to resume in-person learning in September. The WHO and the United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund support the reopening of African schools, with UNICEF reporting that the incidence of violence against children has risen since schools were closed. During the closures, nutrition rates have fallen, with more than 10 million children missing school meals. The UN agencies have published health guidelines that they hope will help schools reopen safely. But education experts say this is no ordinary school year. Professor Labi Ramrathan is an education specialist at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa.
I think the first thing is to recognize that this entire academic year is going to be a disruptive year. That there's not going to be a continuous schooling until the pandemic is almost over. Because when individuals are infected, the school closes. there's protocols are put in place to bring back the safety of the schools. So we're going to consistently experience this. So as if I was the Minister of Education, I would begin to review what is being taught. I would look at the CAPS curriculum. I would work with teachers, senior teachers, and subject advisors to say, what are the core learnings that we can expose our learners to?
And in that way, he says, this pandemic could present a unique opportunity.
What we need to focus is on to say, how is the learning that they're going to receive right now relevant to them? And that requires a kind, almost a review of what we teach in schools and make it relevant to them right now. We shouldn't be focusing on summative examination to say whether the students can progress to the next level or that they will lose out an entire academic year. But we should focus on bits of learning, the units of learning, that we can even assess to test the competences at that level.
The school closures have created other unforeseen opportunities. Recent education graduate Zafira Ahmad built a private teaching business with 7 students between the ages of 3 and 8. Some will return to full-time school, others won't. She acknowledges that her fee, which is about $12 an hour, is out of reach for many South African parents in a country where the minimum wage stands at about $1.20 an hour. She says she sympathizes with the decisions teachers are making right now.
Yeah, I am concerned about contracting the virus, but at the same time, I'm also concerned about the education of children and them lagging behind being out of school. And for me, that concern outweighs the concern of actually getting the virus.
Ahmad says she would much prefer to teach at an actual school and for things to be normal again. But for now, she says she's focused on keeping her students learning. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
A new study on the Sahel Alliance, which includes France, Germany, and the Sahel countries, and was launched in 2017 to better coordinate development assistance in the region, looks extensively at the aims and missteps that the group has taken in the past few years. Report author Andrew Leibovich, a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, says it is important to take a critical look at the program, especially given the deteriorating security situation in Mali, Burkina Faso, and other countries in the region.
It's impossible not to see the development economy and the impact that it has on the region, particularly when you spend time in places like Mali and Niger. And so when this program was announced, amidst this growing security crisis and with the new French presidency, it seemed like a really interesting and innovative idea in a way, because it seemed like it finally represented donor countries looking more critically and looking differently at their own interventions and particularly their development spending. And so that sort of piqued my interest and I wanted to explore further, and I've been looking at it off and on really since then.
I don't know if you have any figures on how much money has gone into, for one, maybe organizing conferences and establishing these alliances, these organizations, these groups, in contrast with how much has maybe been, you know, spent on the ground to the direct benefit of people.
So the first one, I don't know, because that would rely on, I think, a lot of internal government data. So it would be very interesting to know, actually, just looking at all of these summit meetings, and not just the summit meetings, but all of the travel back and forth to the continent, people gathering in Paris or Brussels or Berlin to have these discussions. But to the point about how much is being spent on these programs, with the Sahel Alliance, it's a bit hard to say, because the Sahel Alliance itself is not doling out all of the money for these things. It's partially a way of raising money and of assembling projects that were already being conducted. They consider that under their umbrella there are over 800 programs worth, there are different figures that have been tossed around, but generally around 11.5 billion euro.
Do you think, too, I mean, it was founded in 2017, and yes, things have gotten steadily worse in many of these countries when it comes to security. This is a huge undertaking. Should it in reality take quite a few years to have some kind of positive impact?
Oh, absolutely. But that was part of the point that I was trying to make in the paper, was that you have a very complicated situation. You have very long timelines, potentially. But the international community has a hard time agreeing even on a short-term agenda.
That was Andrew Lebovich, a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Washington, D.C. And that's it for this Thursday, September 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you